specialized area of life 20 years ago, but it was my area. And I had seen a change from a community where people were free to cooperate, where we could follow the principles of scientific cooperation, developing software that was part of human knowledge, into a system of domination where the users were kept divided and helpless by software licenses. In 1983, if you wanted to get a modern computer and use it, you had no choice. Well, you could get an unauthorized copy, but to get an authorized copy of an operating system. I'm mostly known for working on free software. Over 20 years ago, I started the free software movement, which is a movement for freedom for computer users, an area that was a very narrow, specialized area of life 20 years ago. But it was my area. And I had seen a change from a community where people were free to cooperate, where we could follow the principles of scientific cooperation, developing software that was part of human knowledge, into a system of domination where the users were kept divided and helpless by software licenses. In 1983, if you wanted to get a modern computer and use it, you had no choice. I'm known for working on free software. Over 20 years ago, I started the free software movement, which is a movement for freedom for computer users, an area that was a very narrow, specialized area of life 20 years ago. But it was my area. And I had seen a change from a community where people were free to cooperate, where we could follow the principles of scientific cooperation, developing software that was part of human knowledge, into a system of domination where the users were kept divided and helpless by software licenses. In 1983, if you wanted to get a modern computer and use it, you had no choice. Well, you could get an unauthorized copy, but to get an authorized copy of an operating system, you had to sign a promise not to share with anyone else. Now, there's nothing more fundamentally evil than a promise not to help your neighbor. Nothing that directly attacks social bonds. What is society? It's a place in which people have relationships and help each other. When people are forbidden to help each other, this is not just creating alienation, it's forcing people to promise to be alienated and to alienate each other. What? Yeah, well, it's not just that they are sometimes alienated, but they're promising to be alienated, promising to alienate each other. So I looked at that, and I thought, this is evil, and I refuse to live this way. So I decided to build an alternative. I knew nothing, really, about political organizing. I wouldn't have had a hope of starting a movement to change the laws that these licenses are based on, or to convince any company to change its policies. So I didn't try to do those things. What I knew how to do was program. So that's what I did. I decided, forget that evil software. We can't ethically use that software. So let's make an alternative. Let's build software that we can ethically use. Software that you don't have to promise not to share before you can legally get it. And software that's not a secret from people. When you use the ordinary software, most of the programs that are available, what they do is secret, and it's completely under the control of the developer. Which means that you can't even tell what it's doing to you. Now, this is not just a theoretical suspicion. Did you know that if you're using Microsoft Windows and you tell it to search your files for a word, it actually sends a message to Microsoft saying what word you searched for? It's spying on you. And when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it says what software is installed on your machine. So, again, it's giving Microsoft information about you. And there are also features where programs are deliberately designed not to work. This is called Digital Restrictions Management, DRM, where the program is designed to refuse to open certain files, refuse to do certain things with certain files. In other words, designed to refuse to work. And there are many other nasty things that can be in a program. But in general, I'm sure you appreciate what it's like to be living a life where you don't control what your life is like. Well, using that black box secret software is exactly that. It's living a life where somebody else is in control and you are powerless. So, free software is software that respects the user's freedom. It means you're free to run the program as you wish, free to study the source code of the program and change it to do what you wish, free to redistribute copies to others, and also, crucially, free to publish a modified version. So you can distribute the program not just as you got it, but also you can distribute changed versions if you like. And this way, people in the community can work together. Those who are programmers will make changes, and then other people can use those changed versions too if they like them better. So this means everybody in the community gets a say in which versions are the popular ones. And that, of course, means the developers have to try to make the software do what users want. We can't really get away with putting in digital restrictions management. We couldn't get away with doing what Microsoft does and making programs deliberately incompatible, because users won't like that, and somebody will change it, and then everyone will switch to the changed version. So we developers know we don't have that kind of power. You know, we can still make mistakes. We can, you know, no, none of us are perfect. But what we don't do is try to keep you helpless. So after the free software movement had been going on for 10 years or so, and we had a free operating system, it's the GNU operating system together with Linux as the kernel. You'll find many people calling the whole thing Linux, but that's really not fair. We worked on the GNU project, on the GNU operating system, for almost 8 years. Actually, for more than 8 years before Linux was available as free software. And Linux actually is one program that filled the last gap in the GNU system. So the system people use ever since 1992 or so is basically GNU, but there's one important piece that's Linux. So it's the GNU and Linux system. And if you call it that, you'll give us equal mention. And since we started it all, I think we deserve that. Also, another point that you might care about, the GNU project is where all the idealism is. So if you want to help us spread awareness of our ideals of freedom to cooperate, help make the users aware that what they're running is GNU, then they'll be more likely to pay attention to what we said when they come across it. Anyway, when people had been using that for a while, so we were getting some popularity, I started getting invited to give more speeches, and people asked me whether these ideas about free software extend to anything else besides software. And a lot of people would ask wise guy questions. Well, like, what about hardware? Should hardware be free too? Well, remember, free doesn't mean gratis here. It means free as in free speech, not free as in free beer. So it means the freedom to copy and change the thing. So is hardware free in that sense? Well, what about this table? Is this free? Well, yeah. Well, it's as free as it could be. First of all, freedom to copy it. Well, there are no copiers for tables or for blackboards or windows or chairs or cars or computers. That's not how they're made. You have to build each one. Now, maybe someday, with nanotechnology or whatever, maybe there will be copiers for such things. But we don't have to worry about that today. Today's situation is there are no copiers for these things. So the question of whether we're permitted to copy them is about as relevant as the question of whether we're permitted to fly by flapping our arms. We just can't anyway. And what about the question of modifying it? Well, usually if you buy some physical object, you are free to modify it to the extent that that's feasible. You know, I could buy a blackboard like this and I could chop up the wood and burn it in the fireplace if I want. And most things people don't modify much, but consider cars. There are a lot of people who get cars and modify them. It's just because a lot of people are interested. So the answer is physical objects usually are about as free as they could possibly be in this particular sense. That is, the users are free to modify them, and there are no copiers, so it doesn't matter if you're free to copy them. So the question is a real question, not for physical objects, but only for some kind of information. There, these freedoms to copy and to modify do make sense. So we can ask the question, should people have those freedoms? I don't think, however, that all these kinds of works give the same answers. I don't think the answer is the same for all kinds of works. And in this speech, I'll be explaining to you what I think about it. But first, I want to give some background. The question of whether people are allowed to copy works is really the question of what copyright law says, because normally it's copyright law and only copyright law that might stop you. And the history of copyright law is tied up with the history of copying and copying technology. Now, technological changes can't change ethical principles, because ethical principles are too deep. But when we apply our principles to a particular question, we look at the consequences of the available choices. Now, what the consequences are of a specific choice depends on the context. So changes in the technical context can change the good or bad that results from a specific choice and make it better or worse. And that is what has happened in regard to copyright law. Now, before I go any further, I'd like to warn you about a terribly misleading term that I'm sure you've heard people using, and you might have even used yourself. It's the term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, a term you should never use. First of all, it's obviously biased. Today, many people worship the idea of property rights so much that once you manage to label something as property rights, they can't even question it anymore. If you label horse manure as fertilizer property rights, they'd probably eat it. So, the bias is obvious, but what's not obvious is the confusion. You see, when they use that term, they're talking about several different laws that do completely different things, whose requirements are completely different because they evolved independently. And lumping these different laws together ensures that whatever you say about them all at once makes no sense at all. There is no intelligent opinion that you can have about, quote, intellectual property, unquote. It's too big a topic to think about. The only way to think carefully about these various different laws is to look at them one by one. Copyright law, for instance, is totally different in its effects from patent law. They cover different things. They do different things. And when people take these various different laws and treat them as if they were one vague, nebulous kind of everything anybody does has to be a monopoly, it leads people to misunderstand what the legal system actually says, as well as think badly, or fail to even see the specific public policy issues that these various laws raise. The public policy issues of copyright law are different from the public policy issues of patent law and different from the public policy issues of trademark law. These laws evolve to serve different purposes. So we can only talk about one at a time. So, in this talk, I'm talking about copyright and only copyright. The history of copyright law is tied up with the history of copying technology. So let me start in the ancient world, where people copied books with a pen and ink. You'd read a book and you'd write the same things on another piece of paper. Now, this copying technology had certain consequences. One thing was, anybody who was literate could copy about as well as anybody else. Sure, if you spent all day copying books, you'd get faster at it. But it wouldn't take you very many days of copying to get most of the skill. So, essentially, anyone could do it who knew how to read. And another thing was to make, there was no inherent economy of scale. To make 10 copies took 10 times as long as making one copy, because you just had to write it over and over 10 times. Another thing was that copies of a given book could be made wherever there was a copy. There was no need for them to be made in a central place. And indeed, copies of a book were made wherever there was a copy. And another interesting point was that this technology didn't require copies to be identical. In fact, in the ancient world, they did understand the concept of an author. They knew that a certain play was written by Sophocles, for instance. But in between writing a book and copying a book, there were other alternatives that were also useful, worthwhile, appreciated things. For instance, you could start copying a book, but after a while add some new text, and then continue copying and add some more new text, and so on. This was writing a commentary, and it was a respected activity. Another thing you could do would be to write some text of your own and then copy part of a book and then write some more text and then copy part of another book and so on. This kind of work was called a compendium, and they were worthwhile works, as respected works as well. Some ancient works were lost, but large parts of them may have survived in compendia that were more popular or had better luck. Now, as far as I can tell, in the ancient world, there was no concept of copyright. If you had a book and you wanted to copy it, you could, and you did. But copying technology improved. The printing press was developed. The printing press made copying much more efficient, but not uniformly more efficient, because it took a lot. First of all, it took a lot of work to set the type. But once you had set the type, you could make many identical copies very quickly. So the printing press brought an inherent economy of scale. It was much cheaper per copy to make 100 copies than to make one copy. So copying tended to be done in a mass production system. And second, the printing press and the type that went with it was an expensive, specialized piece of equipment that only a few people had, only a few people knew how to use. So the result was that this new method of copying, unlike the previous one, had an inherent economy of scale and was not something every reader could do. So books began to be made in a fairly small number of places and then carried, transported to the places where people wanted to buy them. Now, as far as I can tell, copyright came to exist shortly after the printing press. The earliest reference I've seen is to Italy in the 1500s. Italy was a major center of printing for Europe at the time. And apparently, you could ask one of the various local princes to give you a monopoly on printing a certain book, and the prince could do that if he liked you. Rulers of the day liked to give monopolies as rewards to their favorites, as patronage, essentially. And this was simply one example of that. Now, at the time, a lot of copying was still done by hand. Sometimes, most copies were made by that time on printing presses, but hand copying was still done either for very rich people who were trying to show how rich they were, or by poor people who had no money to buy a book but had the time to copy it. As the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. So they continued copying by hand. But copyright was never applied to them, because copyright was understood as an industrial regulation. It was a restriction on these few specialized businesses, the printers. And because it didn't restrict what an ordinary reader could do in any way at all. And because of this, it was fairly painless, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. Now, beneficial in what sense? At the time, in the 1500s, copyright was a sort of private privilege. But in England, the system was reformed into a scheme to promote authorship. Authors were generally given a copyright for a certain limited period of time. When the U.S. Constitution was written, there was an idea of saying that authors were entitled to a copyright. This idea, you may be surprised to learn, was rejected. What the Constitution says, not that our government cares much anymore, is Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the exclusive use of their respective writings and inventions. And by the way, this sentence... What? I don't know, I'm sorry. You'll have to just look. It was enough work to memorize the text of it. And by the way, when you look at it, you may not see the words Congress shall have the power, because those are stated in one place, and then there are many articles that implicitly start with those words, and people who don't notice that those words are implicitly repeated in this article get the impression that this is a command to give authors this. No, it's not a requirement, it's only an option. Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by reserving to authors and inventors for a limited time the respective use, the exclusive use of their respective writings and inventions. You don't have to write this down, you could look it up. But the point is, what we see is that copyright is not required. It's an option. Second, it has a clearly stated purpose, which is not to make an author richer, let alone to make a publisher richer. It's to promote progress, a social benefit for the public. And any benefit the author gets is simply a way of modifying the author's behavior to suit the public's needs. So this is referred to as the copyright bargain. The public trades away certain freedoms and in exchange gets a benefit. The benefit is more authorship, more books for you to read, more conversation about ideas that can help society make up its mind about what to do, assuming that society is a democracy. And at the time, copyright was fairly painless, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. It was fairly painless because it didn't restrict what the general reading public could do. It only restricted printers. It was easy to enforce because generally anyone printing and selling books has to advertise what books he's got. So there was no need to go into everybody's home to enforce copyright law then. You could just find who was saying, I have such and such book for sale. And it was arguably beneficial because the freedoms that the public traded away were freedoms the general public couldn't use anyway. The general member of the reading public had no printing press and couldn't do what copyright covered anyway, so he wasn't losing anything. And as for the people who did copying by hand, copyright law didn't even cover that until 1909 or so. It was a limitation on publishing. And it was clearly expected to be an industrial regulation, not a restriction on the general public. Now, around 1900 or so, printing presses got faster and more efficient, and the price of printed books went down to the point where almost anyone who could read could afford the book. So the practice of widespread hand copying mostly disappeared, and people started to forget the idea that that might ever happen. But still, copyright, practically speaking, was an industrial regulation. And so things went on more or less okay, and without too much controversy, usually. But the age of the printing press is giving way to the age of the computer networks. Digital information technology is another improvement in copying technology, which makes copying easier and more efficient. And just as happened with the printing press, this improvement is not uniform. Digital information technology makes it once again reasonably efficient to make copies one at a time. And also, now that most people in wealthy countries have computers, once again, efficient copying is available to everyone, equally efficient. It's true, mass producing CDs is cheaper than writing them one by one, but writing them one by one is cheap enough that millions of people can do it. So we're in a situation more like that in the ancient world. The change in the nature of copying brought by the printing press has been reversed, removed. And we're now back in the situation before, the situation where anybody who can use these digital works can also copy them easily enough that everyone wants to and everyone can. And there's no longer a need to make the copies centrally, no longer an inherent economy of scale that requires people to make a large batch of copies and truck them around. Digital information technology is useful because it makes it easier to copy and manipulate information. But not everybody wants this to be easy for you. They want to have a monopoly. They had one before, created by the nature of the technology. Now the technology is different and doesn't create a monopoly for them, so they're trying to artificially impose it. You will hear people saying, for instance, that computers create problems for copyright law. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I would say copyright law creates problems for the use of computers. The result of this change is that the same laws, which in the age of the printing press were fairly painless, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial, now become oppressive because they are no longer, in effect, an industrial regulation. They are now restricting what every computer user does. They're restricting the general public, not just some specialized businesses, which means that they're no longer painless for the general public, for the general computer user. In fact, they're no longer easy to enforce either. It's necessary now to do surveillance on everyone, to invade people's houses, and to launch a campaign of terror, which is what we see. And finally, it's no longer arguably beneficial. The copyright bargain in the age of the printing press meant that we traded away a meaningless freedom that we couldn't exercise anyway, unless we happened to be printers, and in exchange we got something beneficial. So we had this thing that we generated just by living, which was of no use to us, so we sold it. If you sell something that's of no use to you, it's almost sure to be a good deal. But what happens when you develop a use for this thing? What do you want to do then? You want to change the deal. You renegotiate. Now that you can use it, you don't want to sell it all. You want to keep some and use it. And that's exactly what people show they want today by their wide usage of peer-to-peer copying software. They show that people want to copy. They don't want to trade away this freedom anymore. So if we had governments that, if we had government of the people, by the people, for the people, what would that government be doing? It would be renegotiating a deal it made on our behalf, trading our freedom away to certain parties to get something we wanted. It would be selling less of our freedom, allowing us to keep some of that freedom and use it. That's if we had democracy. What we actually see shows us that our system is really a system of corporate rule. What we see is that the corporations that don't want information technology to be directly useful for people have been buying laws to stop it. They've been changing the copyright bargain in the other direction, exactly what we don't want, extending copyright power in unprecedented ways. Now, one dimension where they've been increasing copyright power is the length of time. The Constitution says copyright's supposed to last for a limited time. Well, the movie companies have said they want copyright to last forever. But they can't get that without a constitutional amendment, and that would be hard to do. So, so what do? They get perpetual copyright on the installment plan. The idea is that every 20 years they pass a law extending copyright by 20 more years. So at any given time for any given work, there's a nominal date at which it will go into the public domain. But don't expect to ever reach that date, because as you get close to it, it's going to be moved away from you. Each time you get close to it, it's moved away from you. I fail to grasp how they think extending copyright on works written in the 1920s will incent those dead authors to write more books back then. Perhaps they think that there was a time machine and that they're going to go and tell those authors that you're going to have 20 more years of copyright, so write some more. The law that did this is called the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. Now, why did Sonny Bono want to do this? He was a member of the Church of Scientology. The Church of Scientology uses copyright to attack its opponents. So they told their pet congressman to get on that committee. And then he died, so they named the law after him. But we generally refer to it as the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act, because we think it's the main reason it was passed is that Disney didn't want the copyright on that covers the character Mickey Mouse. Copyright on the first film that had Mickey Mouse, Steamboat Willie, didn't want that to ever expire, so they will buy laws to extend it. Now, also they claim that they need longer copyright on new works to make sure there's enough incentive to produce them. I challenge anyone making that argument to produce prospective balance sheets for 75 years in the future to demonstrate that they won't have enough income 75 years from now unless copyright's extended to 95 years. Well, they already got 95 years. Next, they're going to say they need 115 years. So we can ask them for their prospective balance sheets for 96 years in the future, see if they can possibly come up with them. The whole thing's bullshit. Really, they just didn't want any of the old works that they're just milking to go into the public domain as was promised to us, as is our right. So, what about other dimensions of copyright? Well, another dimension is how broad a power, how big a, how much power does a copyright convey? copyright was never meant to restrict all uses of a copyrighted work, and never did. But the Digital Millennium Copyright Act essentially gave publishers the power to write their own copyright law, as long as they could write it in software code or design it into hardware. The law said that if the player for something, the machine you use to look at it, restricts you in some way, then anything you do to bypass that is a crime, and telling people how to bypass it is a crime. Now, there are some exceptions. There's a concept called fair use, where there's certain kinds of copying that are considered legitimate, and you're supposed to be allowed to do them. But if the machine to bypass the copying restriction is illegal, you can't get it, so you can't do the fair use. Even though that fair use would be considered legal, it's impossible. You know, you want to do fair use from a DVD? Well, you need a DVD player that will let you. But all the DVD players are designed not to let you copy. So what are you going to do? Well, actually, somebody made a free software package to read the film on a DVD. And that meant it was possible, for instance, to take a DVD you have bought and put it into your computer that's running the GNU/Linux operating system, and using entirely free software, you could watch the movie. That is lawful. However, the software that does this has been censored in the US. It is completely forbidden. Even making a link for where to get it from outside the US is forbidden. So this knowledge is forbidden knowledge. There are people who have printed this one version of this program on a shirt. And they sell the shirt.
What size
font is that? Oh, it's a pretty big font. It's because they found a way of making the program just a few lines long.
What country is
this
in?
Is what in?
It's shirt.
Oh, they do that in the U.S. I think they haven't been prosecuted for the shirt. Ah, good. Too bad you didn't wear it here. We could see it.
I didn't know you were speaking until I got here.
Oh well.
Where can you buy the software?
Well, you can't buy it. You can't. No one can distribute it to you legally in the U.S. at all.
You win the shirt.
What? Okay. Maybe you can buy the version on the shirt somewhere. I don't know. Now, there are places outside the U.S. where you can find this program. It's free software, so everyone's free to give it to you gratis or to sell you a copy, but not in the U.S. The U.S. has censored this, and the European Union has followed. However, one of the authors was prosecuted in Norway and was found to be innocent. The Supreme Court ruled that they don't have a law against this. What? I don't know one. I really don't know one. I don't have a DVD player. I don't want to buy a DVD, any DVD. I hate the movie companies so much, I wouldn't do it. The movie companies are the enemy of your freedom. Now, I know that if I urge people to completely boycott Hollywood, that would be seen as too severe. So I have an alternative recommendation. Never pay to see a movie unless you have some specific reason to believe it's really trying to be a good, intelligent, thoughtful movie. Now, this is almost the same thing as a complete boycott of Hollywood. But not quite, so it might seem more acceptable. You know, a lot of people go to movies knowing that they're crap. What dumb thing to do. Now, even if they weren't trying to take away our freedom, why support crap? So stop doing that. If your friends say, let's go to a movie, oh, who cares, any movie. You know, tell them that the movie companies are everybody's enemy. And don't waste your money supporting crap. There's got to be something better to do than that.
Did you see Fahrenheit 9/11?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've read people's comments on it various ways.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure I agree with what it says about Bush. Doesn't go far enough, but it, you know, it may do some good. I'm not going to vote for Kerry. It makes me sad to think that our next president is going to be a militarist who supports corporate rule.
Mm-hmm. He should drop out. He's
going to
cost NATO the election.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think I'm going to vote green because I want the Green Party to stay on the ballot in Massachusetts. Might do some good.
I'm going to do some Pennsylvania.
Anyway, getting back to the topic. So the publishers here have a law that enables them to decide exactly what power they have. Any restrictions they like, they can put into hardware or into a program, and then those restrictions have the force of law. I was with a group of people that went to see Barney Frank to argue against this law. And he said, oh, the movie industry is worried, the record industry is worried. And I said, but what about the public interest? And he said, why are you talking about the public interest? These people don't have to give up their rights for the public interest. So he has forgotten. Yes. He said this, and I was stunned. So not only is he pretending that this, you know, the publishers get this power nominally on behalf of the authors, but the authors all transfer to the publishers. Unless it's a, if it's a movie, it's a, typically a work made for hire, I'd expect, anyway, so a corporation is the author. And these publishers then exercise this power, which supposedly exists not for their sake. They're not entitled to it. They were never entitled to it according to our Constitution. But this shows you how much that is ignored. Or it gets just lip service. So this law was indeed duly passed. In the House of Representatives, it was considered uncontroversial. Nobody insisted there be a vote on it. It just went through without a word. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That was 1998. And you might enjoy looking up some of... There are a couple of versions of songs called DMCA. Yeah, it's hard to live with the DMCA, I guess. I've never actually seen the text of these songs, but they're probably funny. So that's what our government has been doing for us, increasing the power that copyright gives certain parties over the public. But what should governments do? What would they do if they were responding to the millions, tens of millions of people who want more freedom to copy? Well, what we should do is not necessarily abolish copyright, but make it less. Make it so that we trade away less of our freedom and keep some of it so that we can use it in our lives. But before I give recommendations, I want to say that I don't think we should treat all kinds of works alike. The publishers constantly ask us to assume that it's impossible to distinguish between different kinds of works. Well, that's not true. Music is actually treated quite differently from other things. Why do they want us to make this silly assumption that copyright law has to be uniform? Because then they will pick some obscure corner of literary or artistic activity and argue that in that particular corner there's a need for this much copyright power or some of these works won't get made. Now you might respond to that by saying, why should we make a decision based on this obscure corner and a few marginal works? That's not important enough for us to tolerate more power exercised over us across the board. They never expect you to think that way. But anyway, if you will buy that, that in this particular area there's a need for this much copyright power, and if you've believed that point about uniformity, then you'll conclude there has to be this much copyright power for everything. But we don't pay the same price for everything we buy. We wouldn't expect to have to. The economy would come to a halt if we insisted on that. Why pay the same price in freedom to promote every different kind of work? Why can't we make an appropriate bargain for each kind of work, distinguishing in whatever way seems useful to us to distinguish? And of course, courts are there to make distinctions. There's no difficulty making distinctions in copyright law. So I've identified three broad categories of works that I think should be treated differently. Not based on media. That's the first thing everyone thinks of. Treat each medium a certain way. But my distinction is based on the kind of use, the kind of purpose that the work serves in society. So these three categories are functional works, works that state certain parties' thoughts or views, and artistic or entertaining works. So functional works are works that you use for practical purposes. These include things like software programs, recipes, educational materials, and reference works. These works are primarily valued because they help people get something done. So I call them functional or practical works. The second category is the category of works whose main purpose is to say what certain people think, saw, or want. This includes essays of opinion, memoirs, scientific papers, which after all report what certain people saw when they did an experiment, offers to buy or sell, catalogs, and so on. And finally, the third category includes fiction and art. And the purpose of works in that category is to give you an interesting or enjoyable sensation when you use the work. So it doesn't have a further purpose. It is its own purpose. And by the way, I'm not saying that that category is somehow less because its purpose is not more practical, but it's different, and that's what's relevant here. So I have, first of all, would like to recommend that we shorten the time scale of copyright. For most kinds of works, the cycle of publication is getting shorter and shorter. For instance, books today in the U.S. are typically remaindered within 2 years and out of print within 3 or 4. And this is at the same time when they argue that longer and longer copyright is necessary. Well, I think if we shorten copyright to 10 years, that's got to be plenty. What? Well, I'd say let's shorten it to 10 years first. And assuming everything goes okay, then we can look at shortening it some more. You know, there's no reason why we have to be precipitous. I once proposed 10 year... Oh, by the way, that's 10 years from the publication date. It makes sense to allow a work to remain copyrighted before it's published, even if that takes decades. But once it's published, then the author would get 10 years. I once proposed this on a panel with some science fiction writers, and an award-winning author sitting next to me said, 10 years? That's ridiculous. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. Now, you might have been supposing that authors wanted longer copyright. I actually expected that too. But the fact is that the same publishing companies that claim more power over you and me in the name of authors and artists are spitting on those authors and artists all the time, grinding them into the ground with their heels. Now, this award-winning writer had a clause in his contract, which is more or less standard, that when the books went out of print, the rights would revert to him. But as often happens, the publisher was refusing to admit that the books were out of print. And he was trying to get the rights to his books back so he could make them available to people in some other way. And the publisher was mistreating him, as very often happens.
How do they prove it's out of print?
Well, I don't know. I've never been in that situation myself. The books I've written have all been published by the Free Software Foundation, and since I'm the president, and since they all say you're free to copy them, I don't have that problem. So this is a widespread phenomenon, and you see it for many kinds of works. So, I'd say shorten it to 10 years. Now, for software, maybe a 3-year copyright. I don't remember his name, if that's what you're asking.
No, which one is
This is for all of them. I think 10-year copyright would I think is plenty for any kind of thing. Now, we could conceivably make it shorter after that. You know, if we see no ill effects from having shortened it that far, we could try shortening it some more. See where, if and where we notice any diminution in production of works of various kinds, and maybe we could then make it different in different fields or for different kinds of works. Now, the other big question is, how broad should copyright power be? And there, I have different recommendations for different kinds of works. For functional works, they should all be free. The user should be free to use them, study them, modify them, redistribute them, and even publish modified versions, commercially or non-commercially. Because, you know, if a modified version is useful, commercial publication of it is useful too. So this has to go on so that the public can have control of the works it uses.
So that's immediately after publishing?
Yes. If you have a copy, you should be free to do all those things. So now I've answered the question that people ask me. This is how far I think the ideas of free software generalize to other kinds of functional works, works which, like programs, serve a practical purpose in life. If you can't change and control the works that you use, then the publishers of those works have power over you, which they shouldn't have. Now, somebody might worry, if everyone's free to do these things, will these works get produced at all? Can we do without the incentive factor of the income stream produced by copyright? Well, in this field, there's evidence that we can. First of all, there's the free software community, which has produced a broad spectrum of software. We now have complete operating systems, complete graphical desktops, complete office suites, more than one of each, and lots of application programs. The Free Software Directory lists over 3,000 usable free software packages. This is not to count many others in development. And that's not all the ones that are usable either. You know, we can only add them to the directory at a certain rate. You can find this directory on www.gnu.org/directory. And so you can look up free software packages for various purposes. We will list any free software package that is in usable state and runs on the GNU/Linux system without requiring any non-free software. Now, you might ask, you can ask questions at the end. You might ask whether we can be confident of this for other kinds of practical works. Well, we're starting to see evidence for this. There are a number of projects to develop free curriculum materials for schools. And Meanwhile, there's now a free encyclopedia called Wikipedia, which is the largest encyclopedia in history, although I'm sad to say that they give wrong information about what Linux is. So I hope that some of you will... What? The encyclopedia? The encyclopedia is called Wikipedia. What? Well, I tried editing one of those things a few days ago, and I haven't looked to see if someone changed it back. But those pages are changed very often. You know, I saw several changes a day in the change log of those pages when I did that. So I suspect someone changed it back. I'd like to ask all of you to go to those those pages every day and change them. And, you know, let's get those people who have been misled. It's so sad. There are people who say, well, everyone calls it this, that makes it right. We have no patience for anyone who disagrees, so we're just going to make it say this, and there are more of us, and we argued about this before. That doesn't justify it. So I hope it won't just be me to fix that page. It's going to take a lot of people to keep fixing it to outdo the people who want to call the system Linux. Anyway... There's a lot of evidence, therefore, that in the field of functional works, we can do the job. We don't need to restrict the users to get the works written. So what about the other two categories? The next category is works that express someone's point of view or experiences. And for these works, I think that making modified versions is not a contribution to society. It's misrepresenting someone else's views. Quoting from these works is useful, but modifying them is not. So, as I see it, there's no need, society has no need to authorize everyone to publish modified versions. This means that there is no problem having copyright cover all commercial use of these works. Remember, for the functional works, we need to make people free to produce modified versions. And in order for those modified versions to be fully available, we need to allow commercial use of them too. But if we're not going to permit modified versions, we don't have that argument applying. So we could say that everyone is free to non-commercially redistribute verbatim copies, but that commercial use and modification are still covered by copyright. This brings us back to a situation like the situation of copyright in the age of the printing press, where it now permits what the citizens generally want to do. So copyright once again becomes more or less easy to enforce and fairly painless, and thus perhaps beneficial. And so this compromised copyright system will continue producing more or less the revenue stream that it does now, and therefore will have the same factors supporting the production of these works as we have now. And finally, there's the category of artistic and entertainment works. For these works, modification can be useful. There is a controversy about whether modification is a good thing. On the one hand, there's the argument, which has some validity, that a work can have a kind of integrity and someone else can modify it and destroy that integrity. And this is sometimes the case. On the other hand, we can also see that modified versions of works can be very great contributions. First of all, look at the folk process, where a long series of people over a long time modifying something produced something very rich. But if we want to look at works by named authors, consider some of Shakespeare's plays, which use plots copied from plays written a few decades before. If today's copyright law had been in effect then, those plays of Shakespeare would have been illegal. And most likely he would not have been allowed to ever publish them or produce them. And if he had complained about this, I'm sure the copyright holders would have said that he was just trying to make cheap ripoffs and that it was ridiculous to think he should be allowed to write such plays. And we consider those cheap ripoffs, as they would have been called, to be among the masterpieces of literature. So, modifying artistic works, adapting them, can be a very good thing, although it can also be a very bad thing. But people don't need to modify an existing work to produce crap. They can write crap just starting from nothing. So, we should have some way for people to modify existing artistic works and produce new ones. However, it's not as urgent as it is with functional works. If you're using a certain work and you don't like it today, you've got to be free to change it today, because otherwise it's controlling you. But an artistic work doesn't control people in the same way. You may not quite like it. You may have an idea for how to change it, but if you had to wait 10 years, it wouldn't be a disaster. So it might be okay if for 10 years there's the same compromised copyright system, and after 10 years the copyright expires and then you can make modified versions. By the same token, we might want to consider after 10 years for the works that state people's views or thoughts, we might want to continue a limitation on modifying them even after the other aspects of copyright have expired. So, I've gone through now my recommendations for how we should change copyright law to return it to the purpose stated in the Constitution, to promote the progress of science and the useful arts, without hurting the public too much, without getting in the way of the use of the works copyright is meant to produce. Now, this would, for instance, mean that sharing music on the internet would be legal, non-commercially, that is. And that's as it should be. Tens of millions of people want that freedom, and there is no excuse for denying it to them. The record companies are launching a campaign of terror. They are arrogant bullies. There's nothing wrong with companies making records and selling them. And I think it's reasonable to have a compromised copyright system that would cover this commercial use and make them pay the musicians, something which they don't do now. But these record companies deserve only one thing, and that's to be eliminated. These arrogant bullies deserve to go out of business. Let me read to you what EMI in Germany said to its customers who complained about the corrupt discs that they were selling in place of compact discs. These, they look like CDs, but they're designed so that they don't work right, and you can't copy them on your computer. You can't properly read them into your computer. So, if you plan to continue protesting about future audio media releases with copy protection, forget it. Copy protection is a reality, and within a matter of months, more or less, all audio media worldwide are copyright protected, and this is a good thing for the music industry. In order to make this happen, we will do anything within our power, whether you like it or not. Now, this is a translation from German, and I'm told the original is much nastier. These companies deserve to disappear. And the way to do this is don't buy corrupt discs. There are websites that list corrupt discs. And I'd like to suggest the idea that people protest in front of record stores, handing out leaflets explaining this, and with a list of corrupt discs on the back. And it's a great way to recruit people as well as to put pressure on. So,
I work with downhillbattle.org, and that's what we do.
Oh, great.
We're about promoting independent music by crushing the big record companies, by promoting file sharing, and people making
great.
Their own
could you send me email about this?
Sure.
Awesome.
rms@gnu.org.
Sure.
I'm glad people are doing that. Anyway, now, it would be nice, perhaps, to have a compromised copyright system that would require the record companies to pay the musicians, because they don't. The record companies demand more power in the name of the musicians. 4% of the income of the gross sales of the major record companies goes to musicians. Now, this is not a uniform 4%. Of the sales price. But this is not a uniform 4%. The superstars get more than 4% of the large sales figures for their records. The other musicians get much less than 4% of the lower sales figures of their records. In fact, they usually get nothing. Janice Ian, who had hit records in 1970, said she never saw a royalty statement that didn't say she owed the company money. The way they do it is, nominally, for every record sold, there's a certain amount that's royalties for the musicians, but the production and publicity expenses are labeled as an advance, even though this is money that the musicians never saw, and so the sales have to pay that back before the musicians start to get anything, and it's very rare that that happens, unless you're a superstar. Now, the superstars actually eventually get a better contract. The reason is the initial contract will require 5 or 7 records, and until you've published that many, you're not allowed to publish anything in any other way. Now, if you get through that and you're very popular, at that point you can then negotiate some contract that doesn't exploit you, where you really get money for the records that you sell. But it's only a tiny fraction of musicians that get to that point, and they're rich anyway. They don't need this. Not that I loathe the idea that they get this money, but there's no reason for society to make sacrifices to get it to them. We don't need to sacrifice our freedom to get it to them. So, this means that most musicians who have record contracts, of course, most musicians have no record contracts, but of the fraction that do, most of them are not getting money when you buy a record. I feel ashamed when I buy a commercial CD because I know I'm probably not supporting the musicians. I would feel more comfortable, if ethically, if I could copy the music and send the musicians some money, but there's no easy way to do that. Now, what this means is that what musicians do get from their record contracts is publicity. Well, that's useful for them. It means more people coming to their concerts and so on, more people hearing their music, which is something most musicians really want. But there's another way to give them publicity. Let people share their music on the internet. This is healthy publicity. The record company, the music factory publicity, they call it the music industry, which means really it's music factories. They bring in truckloads of hype, and they squeeze it, and they produce these things that they call music. This is not healthy for music. If we let the publicity happen through music sharing, we'll get rid of the hype factor, and I think music will be healthier for it. And most musicians won't lose anything. So that by itself would be a great change. But if we want to do even more to promote music, I have a couple of suggestions. We could have a tax on blank media, which for some of them there is, and we could spend it in a way designed to effectively support musicians, which means all the money goes to musicians and composers and songwriters, none to corporations. And it should be distributed based on sampling, not based on record sales, so that musicians who aren't selling records still get counted. And it should be distributed not in linear proportion to popularity, but the the function that controls it should taper off slowly, so that once you get more popular than a certain point, the fraction you get rises more and more slowly with further increases in popularity. If we calculate this right, we could arrange to support a larger number of musicians at an adequate standard of living so that they can be full-time musicians. So this will be the most effective way to use this money to support music, which is, after all, supposedly the point of having copyright on music. digital audio tapes are taxed, and the players are taxed also. But the money is allocated based on record sales, and more than half of it goes to corporations.
The only problem is always with distributing money to musicians, it has to go through the union, and that's its own can of worms.
Maybe so.
You don't have a distribution system to get the money to musicians.
Well, we could always make one. I can't believe that's going to stop it. And if the government is distributing this money, the government isn't required to do it through a union. This would be tax money, and it would be distributed according to the rules. And in fact, it is already, you know, the existing system does give a certain fraction of the money to musicians.
Can I suggest a model that's come about because of pirating?
I'm sorry, pirating has nothing, piracy has nothing to do with this. Piracy is attacking ships.
Right. No, I admire pirates, which is why I prefer to use pirates.
Actually, pirates nowadays, when they attack a ship, they kill the whole crew. It just happens in Indonesia, for instance.
What groups are doing now, for instance, even symphony orchestras are beginning to do this. Classical music, as anybody who knows who buys CDs, the repertoire is awful. All they keep on doing is Tchaikovsky shit. But because the means of making CDs are so easy now, some of the small artists even come this way. You can hear a live artist, and then you can actually buy the performance after the performance. It's taped, and it's put right onto a CD. And
sounds good.
You would get live performances, which are, in my opinion, usually superior to taped performances. Those who want studio performances can always get them.
I think it's a fine thing for them to do.
It's starting to happen, and there are also stations which are put out now, where they have all of these small artists, where all of the money goes both to the station. These are web stations.
Yeah.
And the artists, I can't remember, Apple has one of the companies on its
anyway,
iTunes.
This is a good idea. I'd like to go to my other proposal, another completely different idea for how we could further support music if we want to. The idea is that every time you play a song, there should be a button you can press if you like that says, send a dollar to the musicians. And if you push that, which you don't have to, it'll send a dollar. Now, to make this work, it has to be painless. It can't require you to have a credit card and so on. And it should be anonymous. If this is painless enough, I think a lot of people will do it. After all, the average amount that Americans spend today on music is around $17 per year, I believe. And it's the price of one CD. And of that, the musician's probably going to get zero unless she's a superstar. Now, if you spent, say, $3 a year on music by sending a dollar three times, that's $3 that would go to musicians. If we could convince people to do this once a month, that would be $12. They'd be spending less money, and it would all go to musicians. Now, instead of having propaganda campaigns saying, don't share, if you share, you're a pirate, sharing with your neighbor is the same as attacking a ship, we could have a much more natural PR campaign that fits in with human nature, saying, did you support one of your favorite bands this month? If not, send a dollar. Look how little a dollar is these days. Why not? Now, of course, people who are poor, people who are on the edge, won't do this. And they shouldn't have to. But people who are not, you know, who would miss $1? So that's where the money will come from. And given how how much many people love bands, I think we'd see a lot of money flowing to the bands that way. Now, similar things have been tried with books and have had some success. Stephen King tried an experiment. He published a book on the net in as a serial, and he said that when he got to the middle of it, if a large enough fraction of people voluntarily paid, he would write and publish the other half. He said the experiment was a failure because only 50% of the people paid. He only got a few hundred thousand dollars, which by his standards was unacceptable. So he didn't finish the book. But I think that this shows, rather than being an example of failure, it really shows that this method can work.
Yeah.
Now, to take the other extreme, somebody published his first novel on the net and got around $1,000. Now, I believe the odds against having your first novel published are something like 40 to 1. So if he could have expected to get $40,000 for his first novel, if supposing it had been published, his expected income would have been the same as what he got. So this is a fair amount of success. If we make it easier and more painless to pay, we'll have more success. You know, I might feel like it would be nice to send a dollar to a band, but I have no easy way to do so. By the way, I generally won't buy anything with a credit card unless they have to know my name, so I don't want to be in a database. So I'll only use an anonymous method. The existing methods that use credit cards tend to be rather inefficient for payments as small as a dollar. So we'd need to set up this system. But once it was set up, I think it would do a great job. So now, I am done. And before I take questions, I'd like to mention that there are some FSF giveaways.